You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
Hello and welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your needless moral panic of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Straight out of Compton, it's a crazy brother named Ice Cube. From the stupid dope gang with an attitude. When I'm caught off, I got a sawed off. Kick knowledge and bodies are hauled off. You too, boy, if you get with me. The police are gonna have to come and get me off your back. That's how I'm going out.
You are listening to Straight Outta Compton, or at least a redacted version thereof. Redacted, as with all great things, sometimes. I am here to talk about NWA and to talk about Straight Outta Compton, talk about Dr. Dre's comeback. My guest this week is someone who watched the ride up close and saw it firsthand. I have Reggie Dennis. What's up, Reggie?
Greetings.
If you are unaware, Reggie was an early editor at The Source from 1990 to 1994, primarily the music editor, and then was the founding editor of XXL Magazine in the late 90s. When it came down to talking to NWA, it seemed only right to have you here to kind of shed light on things that maybe Straight Outta Compton the movie and Dr. Dre's Compton the album conveniently choose to not shed light on or elide or blur. Because I think that seems to be a recurring theme, at least in my opinion, about how that album and that film function. Just throwing that out there. It's a hot start.
A case of revisionist history?
Exactly, right?
Hot takes abound.
Yeah, edit much? Let's start with the movie, which comes out today, and I know you've seen and I've seen. A thing that struck me, just on a very basic structural level, that movie kind of cleaves into two parts. One is, here are these guys, they finally come together, there's an ascent, and it's a glory tale. It's basically guys who shouldn't have this are suddenly gifted and given, because of their talent, access to the world. So that's the first hour and a half. And then to me, the second hour and a half or whatever is basically like, now in real life, all those guys are super powerful and don't want their legacies to be tarnished in any way. And they want to sort of bolster for the modern age their current persona. So what you see is a lot of kind of a massage in the second half to me. When you watched it, what are some of the things that jumped out at you, both positive and negative, about how the group was represented and how these folks as grown men, and in the case of Easy, his widow, how they chose to have themselves represented in the film?
Well, I think if you're doing a movie about your past, you definitely want to be as sympathetic as possible. You don't want to be the villain of your own story, but it's a music industry story. It's a story about art. It's a story about survival. It's a story about very young people conquering the world and having to make decisions with possibly no adult guidance. You're a hip-hop artist in California. Who are you even going to approach with questions? How are you going to solve problems? So I thought what the movie did right, and we can start there, mm-hmm. maybe in like the first 50 minutes. Mm-hmm. How do you tell the story of West Coast hip-hop? How do you describe Compton, California of 1986? Describe Los Angeles of that time? Because you have to get to the story so quickly. This has a cast that rivals the size of like The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone has a movie in them.
Each individual person.
Yes.
Well, yeah, the thing that's striking about certainly the beginning of that film is, you know, it's like a superhero film in the set, like a super group.
The superhero Avengers?
Yes. Because the thing is, you have to have backstory. You have, in essence, it's like a superhero super group film. You don't have prequels. You didn't watch the Making of Dre story, the World Class Wrecking Crew story prior to this. So you have to have 5 to 10 minutes for each guy to figure out how a young kid becomes Dre, how a young kid becomes Cube, how a young kid becomes Easy.
Exactly. That worked because also your audience might not know what was going on back then.
Mm-hmm.
They might not know much about NWA. They'll know about Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, and everything that
the context
came after.
Yeah, and the context that birthed them.
But that context to show what a long shot they were. The sort of, you know, spectacular rise and fall all within 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the film perfectly captured that, because unless you lived in those times, you know, you have no point of reference.
this is something, generally speaking, and I wrote about this a little bit in the piece I wrote about the film. This is something that hip-hop movies tend to be good at. Hip-hop movies are bad at a lot of things, but they tend to be good at the early part, the kind of rise, the up-from-nothing part.
They come up.
Yeah, because it's romantic, it's political in a way, it's an underdog story. It's a very conventional Hollywood narrative. You want to root for these people. And I thought what this movie did was make it very clear from the first 15 or 20 minutes, these guys were folks you're supposed to root for.
Well, from the first 10 minutes, in the 80s in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Police Department utilized a battering ram, mm-hmm. which was a tank with a long turret that would smash through your home. Straight Out of Compton does such a great job not only utilizing that equipment, mm-hmm. but actually just shows you communities under siege.
Yeah, the terror of living in those yes. communities. Mm-hmm. Whether it's that scene, the very first scene with Easy going for the drug deal and then the tank with the turret comes through the door, or it's Cube getting roughed up by the cops in front of his parents as he's trying to leave to go home one day. There's very specific, detailed interactions that each of them have with cops.
It's like the organizing principle of their lives. Mm-hmm. How do you go from point A to point B, whether you're doing good, whether you're doing wrong? The state is interfering with you, or you're interfering with the state. Mm-hmm. And most of them would say, we were just trying to survive. Our survival was made even more difficult by state interactions. So, you know, I have a friend who worked in Los Angeles for a newspaper, and he basically concluded after 6 months that F the police could have been made by any rap group mm-hmm. anywhere in the country, but there's a reason why it was a Los Angeles group that mm-hmm. made that record.
Sure. So that's something, again, is both effective because of its truth value, and it's also effective because from a Hollywood perspective, that's what Hollywood, like we're talking a $30 million studio film. Like, that's what $30 million or $300 million studio films do, is they give you a hero. They build the hero and they present it to you. And then at a certain point, almost by definition, as NWA becomes fundamentally more complicated as an act and as a social presence, and then it starts to splinter, which happens throughout the film. That's, to me, is when the film also starts to, like, not hold water as much.
Well, you've seen that movie before. You've seen Behind the Music. Mm-hmm. You've even seen, as it's been brought up, CB4 in Fear of a Black Hat.
Yep.
It's well-worn territory. But if you're seeing this for the first time, it has to ring true. It has to have an internal logic, which I think the film does. Mm-hmm. You know, this movie is over 2.5 hours.
It's dumb long.
Which, you know, I felt, you know, they could have used another hour and a half to really get into more of the conflicts, but just to tell the narrative mm-hmm. in bare bones form. 2.5 hours, which I don't know that any other hip hop themed movie
has been that long.
Nearly that long.
No, I don't. I think that it's that there hasn't been. And apparently, I think I read in the Hollywood Reporter that the first cut of the film was maybe actually 3 hours and, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that. And that
it needed like a Godfather Scarface intermission mm-hmm. in the film. That's what we needed. This needed to be 4 hours long.
So, once the group becomes the group, once they're no longer on the come up, and once they are on the up, as you're watching it, did it feel sympathetic to you? Did it feel massaged or manipulated? Like, how did it feel to you? Did it resonate?
It did resonate, knowing certain things about the true backstory, and so sort of the character dynamics and the personalities involved. But like the group, there wasn't a lot of time for them to even sit back and assess what was going on.
Right.
This just happened immediately. You put out an underground record, which was Boys in the Hood.
Mm-hmm. And that's 87.
It takes off locally. You shoot a video for Eazy-E's next song. You shoot a video for Straight Outta Compton, mm-hmm. the first single from NWA. At the same time, MTV starts. Your MTV Rap starts.
Mm-hmm. In 88.
It's broadcast all over the nation.
Mm-hmm.
You're immediately at the level of Public Enemy and Run DMC.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone wants to know, what are you talking about? I've never heard anything like this on a record.
And just for some timeline perspective, so Boys in the Hood 12-inch is 87, if I'm not mistaken. It's early to mid-87. And 87 is also the NWA and the Posse album.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So that's after the Boys in the Hood single. Straight Outta Compton single and album is 88. Yo Until You Raps is 88. I don't remember.
That's the summer of 88, which might have been like the greatest
rap
summer of music.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly rap music, when, you know, you're really looking at the extended Mount Rushmore, all recording at their peak at the same time.
Sure.
Vying for the crown.
Mm-hmm.
Which was being vacated by Run-DMC at that point.
And with the rise of Yo Until You Raps, actually all of a sudden people have a way of talking. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, people may not remember this in an age of internet ubiquity, but regionalism was a very real thing in the mid-80s, certainly. I mean, up until the 2000s even. But certainly at that era, if you were a local star, like, you were probably a local star, especially if you were not coming from New York. It took a lot to be something bigger than a local star. Yeah, a lot of dominoes had to fall.
When Boys in the Hood came out, the original song, no one knew in Los Angeles, no one knew who N.W.A. was. Like,
right.
That wasn't like a known quantity. Who was Eazy-E? Who was this rapper? And there were rumors that Eazy-E was 15 years old, mm-hmm. because he sounded like he could have been, mm-hmm. you know, an adolescent talking about the things that he talked about. So there was always an aura of mystery, like from the very beginning, which I don't know how you sell records in any era. I don't know how you get a career started without the curiosity from the consumer. Mm-hmm. You know, you've already reached them and they want to know more.
And Eazy, and you know, it's also important to remember, like, that first 12-inch comes out like via Mecola. And Mecola, again, which I don't think exists anymore. I'm pretty sure it doesn't exist. Mecola was effectively just a pressing plant that would put their logo on label on 12-inches. And you could put your logo on, but Mecola, and anything could come out on Mecola, like literally anything. So you had to do quite a bit to stand out amidst the whatever they pressed 1,000 copies of right before you and whatever they pressed 1,000 copies of right after
you. You take your records, you go to your local record stores, you sell them on consignment,
mm-hmm.
and the consumers would vote.
Right.
I don't know that radio was an option, and certainly not for the type of music N.W.A. or Eazy-E was putting out at the time.
When did K-Day come into play?
It's around the same time.
Late 80s.
It's there. It's established.
Yeah.
And maybe K-Day is the only station that ever got it right,
mm-hmm.
concerning hip-hop.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I sometimes think my future life is opening a New York K-Day. Like, that's just going to be, like, my later situation. If anybody out there wants to fund me, you just, you know, send me an email.
Evergreen rap.
Yeah, just holler.
Yes.
So all those things. So basically, and then Yo Until You Rap comes along. And then, you know, I have this very vivid memory of watching and seeing, you know, it's Fab Five Freddy on the back of the... On the flatbed truck driving through Compton those guys.
That was crazy.
And that was... I don't know if that was 88. That might have been 89. I'm not sure. It was around...
It's by the time, you know, when they got out of studio and started to see the country.
Right.
So so you knew who they were, but did you really see a filmed interview? Did you see them at the Compton swap meet?
Mm-hmm.
Did you even see Compton for the first time?
Right.
Like, it was all a revelation to people on the East Coast, especially.
There also, at that moment, wasn't equivalent East Coast. I mean, maybe Schooly D, I guess, abstractly, is roughly working similar territory. But generally speaking, the East Coast rappers of that day, or the New York, especially the New York specific rappers, that's, I mean, you know, maybe some of Care, maybe some BDP stuff.
If you were a gangster, you got into art to sort of leave that element of your character behind.
Mm-hmm.
So when Schooly D is talking about the PSK, the Parkside Killers of Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
he's giving them props. He's telling you who he is, but he's not making a career of being your Parkside Killer
right.
anymore. He's just telling you what it is. N.W.A., without specifically mentioning gangs
sets
mm-hmm. or getting very specific, they painted the portrait of what was actually happening and all of the difficulties in getting from point A to point B. It's a little bit different, and they rap about things in a different way. It's more profane.
Mm-hmm.
It's more profane. It's more thoughtful. If someone could have made a record about lawless activity, made an entire album about it, like, it really would have been done. But who would be the audience for that? Who would want to hear relentless street tales
mm-hmm.
over and over and over? Because you would feel that you've told the tale after like three songs.
And yet it turns out that literally everybody wants
but,
to hear
but
that.
But N.W.A. Yeah. could have made 20 albums
exactly.
that would have been as compelling even when they got beyond things that they'd seen or experienced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then they could, you know, actually start telling brand new narratives about, oh, well, maybe this could have happened or I heard about this.
Mm-hmm.
But in Eazy-E, you had someone that was actually in the streets. In Ice Cube, you had someone that was removed from the streets but still had an affinity and could tell those stories.
Ice Cube is a lot more like Nas than I think people are willing, have historically been willing to say, in part because the music that Ice Cube make was fundamentally different. Nas's was fundamentally making observer music, and Ice Cube was making participant music, in essence. But in terms of the specific skill set that they share, it's, in essence, the same skill. But Ice Cube did it in a maybe in an era where you couldn't, I think Nas could be Nas because there was an N.W.A. You kind of needed to get through an N.W.A. to have the set, the next generation.
But it's,
like
it's the observation, but Nas's observations about selling drugs, well, there are only so many ways to sell drugs, and certainly back then. So those things would always would ring true all over the country. The Ice Cube stuff, you'd wonder, like, why are they in this position? What happened? What is going on in this part of the country that's allowing this to happen? And mm-hmm. it's become so stratified within the culture that it's like mm-hmm. now it's on a record.
Mm-hmm.
And when people say we're only reporting like what we really see, it's like, yes, you know, don't blame the messenger. You blame the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been happening for generations.
Yeah, it's state neglect and state terror, mm-hmm. like those two things working in tandem. So basically, in your mind, exactly how toxic was L.A. in that particular time period in, you know, 87 to 90, basically?
We would have no idea if you didn't go to Los Angeles, if you didn't know people there. If you just listened to Straight Out of Compton, you thought that the city was on fire, gunshots ringing out at every moment. But even at its worst, there had to be safe havens where you could actually get from point A to point B and make art.
Mm-hmm.
So where someone like Ice Cube could take the stories from the streets and articulate what the streets were saying, you compare him to an MC Ren, who had amazing talent, but if he was from a community where everyone was a CPA, that's what he would have been.
Mm-hmm.
He's the type of guy that would do everything that was in front of him. Unfortunately, you know, he was a gangbanger.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, he was a rapper. But there was a limit probably to his curiosity just based on environment.
Mm-hmm.
So you had Eazy-E who's spinning these tales of fantasy and humor. You have Ice Cube who's dealing with the realities and some of the politics. And you have Ren who very dispassionately talks about the mundane gangster life with no embellishment, no excitement. And you're like, what is this here? He's not even trying to sell it.
Which is its own provocation
yes.
in its word way. You know, maybe he didn't intend it as such, but it ends up becoming such.
And he's one of the great rappers ever and certainly one of the best to come out of, you know, California.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know that from the movie, though, just for worth noting.
But back then, if you're listening to Melly Mel, you're listening to Grandmaster Caz, which everyone had to if you were going to be a rapper.
Mm-hmm.
Run DMC is showing you how to perform. MC Ren has this flow that he doesn't get credit for. These very competent rhymes, sometimes very complex, but simple subject matter, almost like a Hemingway, where it looks simple, but you know, try to write like Hemingway, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
So
if you thought these were posers, if you thought this was just a group that was just trying to cash in on hysteria.
Yeah, shock theater.
MC Ren, well, this guy seems authentic. And he was the anchor to the group. And I agree, he gets relatively short shrift in the film, almost as an afterthought.
Yep.
But I don't know how far NWA goes without the talents of MC Ren.
But again, this is sort of to me where some of the frustrations of the second half of the movie, this is like a sort of corollary to those frustrations, which is three of the executive producers of this film are Dr. Dre, who we haven't talked about yet, Ice Cube, and Tamika Woods Wright, who is Eazy-E's widow, who are all deeply invested in telling a story that they want told on a screen that a million people are going to watch in a movie theater and countless millions will watch in their homes at some point. So if that means shunting MC Ren off to the side, giving the character 10 lines in the film, then so be it.
But I think it's more than that, because I don't know that the DJ Yella character has more lines than Ren,
mm-hmm.
yet the DJ Yella character steals every scene he's in.
Mm-hmm.
You might not know what he does in the group from the movie.
That's true.
But you know that they needed him around
yes.
for some reason, maybe for comic relief, for MC Ren to be introduced as, oh, this is my man Ren.
Right.
When he's in the studio working, to choose Quiet on the Set as his performance when If It Ain't Rough is one of the great lyrical performances of all time.
Mm.
I thought that was a miss.
Yeah.
Swing and a miss.
Mm-hmm. And as far as Yella, I mean, Dre is given tremendous credit in the film for the sound of NWA, but my understanding has always been that there was a dynamic between Dre and Yella.
It was high powered productions.
Yeah.
They were together, and you know, sure, you can overlook JJ Fad.
Mm-hmm.
You can overlook, you know, a lot of the things that they did, but working together and producing all of that work, maybe you don't get the polished Dr. Dre
that you end up with post-NWA.
Without digging those ditches.
Right.
There's probably a noticeable difference in the Dr. Dre music that's done without Yella or without Yella's influence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was probably a good guy just to have around for quality control.
Mm-hmm. Gut check stuff. That makes sense. But again, not reflected in the film. You know, obviously it's not just a sanitized narrative in some ways, but obviously an extremely streamlined narrative. So that's just necessarily be the case. So we've talked sort of the context of where it was coming from. Let's talk about how that music started to trickle. Because you were here, you were in New York. How did it start to trickle to this coast in a way where it got to your ears in that era?
I can only tell a personal story, but when I was in college, I would, you know, because every college is next to the hood.
Mm-hmm.
So I go over to the hood and I go to the record store. And it was called Varsity Records, and they had every record you could imagine. It was very unorganized, and the owner would let me just, like, dig through the crates. And he would stock every record that came out. And
of all genres.
Every record was there, but if you didn't get there when it came out, it would just get lost in the sargasso of unopened boxes of music.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going in and seeing Two Shorts, Born to Mac, and that, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe either the NWA album or We Want Easy, the mm-hmm. Eazy-E album. And I would buy like everything that came out
mm-hmm.
because the local stuff, I could get on the mix shows, you know, that stuff was available. But if you told me it was from Florida, Los Angeles,
Texas
mm-hmm. I was very curious. The NWA stuff got a word of mouth that I hadn't seen since maybe Sucker MCs,
mm-hmm.
where everyone was talking about it. And being 1988 or so, there are no media outlets covering this stuff. There's no way to know to learn more. You don't know what's real, what's fantasy. It was a new way to present the music. And it was very accomplished for people that you never heard of,
mm-hmm.
you know. So people in the underground just gravitated towards it because, you know, you're hearing something that you've never heard on a record before. And
mm-hmm.
you know, almost 10 years into recorded rap music, and you've heard a lot of things by now, but this was like they were using, you know, rap and hip hop as a tool for a different agenda. And we were very curious and maybe very protective of our art, right? It was proprietary.
So you're suspicious.
It was East Coast.
Right, you're suspicious.
What are they doing here? But the quality, you know, it saves the day. And, you know, there was no denying it. It just made us question, well, what's going on the East Coast? And why aren't we telling these stories?
Right.
But in the underground, simultaneously, we're getting Criminal Minded.
Mm.
We're getting things, Big Daddy Kane, Eric B. and Rakim. There's an imagery that's saying that we're not just rappers. We're taking our cues from something else that's going on in the community.
Mm-hmm.
But where East Coast rap was concerned, maybe it wasn't about snitching on yourself and getting into specifics.
Mm-hmm.
It was just enough to turn the Paid in Full album, Eric B. and Rakim, turn that album to the back cover and look at the Paid in Full posse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was self-evident who they were.
And what they were.
And if you were from that area, you knew exactly who they were.
Right.
They didn't have to make records about that, but there was no doubt that Rakim had seen things in his life, maybe participated in things. But it was enough that you would get a sense. He didn't have to explain himself.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas N.W.A.
was literal.
It was literal, and they had to keep reminding you over and over. So, and I guess, like, growing up, you know, in Los Angeles or growing up in those communities and under those conditions, it's always a battle. You have to be who you say you are.
Mm-hmm.
You have to always prove it. And we never felt that. You had to, if you were really what you were talking about, you didn't have to prove it. It would be self-evident. So we were a little suspicious, but it was always mitigated by the quality of the material. But like I said, there wasn't a lot of time to ruminate on NWA because there were all these things happening in hip hop all over. It was, I'll say, one of the best times to be a fan.
Sure.
Because
so it's BDP, it's Public Enemy.
Every three weeks, something came out. The manner that the stuff was expressed was different. The criticism of West Coast rap at the time was that the music was 6 months behind what was happening on the East Coast. You know, you can make those arguments, but it was different priorities, right? West Coast people get into a groove, they just want to stick with it a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
On the East Coast, when certain styles played out, they played out hard.
And
the next generation said, we don't want anything to do with what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned De La Soul. When De La Soul comes up, the first thing they do is distinguish themselves from the LL Cool J archetype.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they have nothing in common except they're rappers.
Right.
But it's a totally different approach. Where East Coast music began to get more artistic. And remember, these are still young people creating this stuff. So, you know, there was like a year, there's like 6 months where there was a lot of ship jumping, like house music, there was club music, there was a lot of people want to enjoy themselves or enjoy like
hip house.
They want to enjoy their ill-gotten gains. They wanted to go out. They didn't want to, you know, be in a grimy club. It was being pulled in different directions, and I thought the West Coast and later Houston was like, oh, no, we have to ground this culture in what it is.
Right.
You know, we're really talking about the blues. We're talking about our conditions. It's a racial argument over an economic argument because, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you make, you still are going to be seen by society in a certain light.
Right.
So there's no sense in running away from it. You should embrace the things better, that got you here.
And better to be the actual voice of it than to have the voice told, have the story told about you. Better to tell the story. Okay, so you get to the Source in 1990. The Source starts in 88, I think, at Harvard. And then by 90, it's in New York. It's publishing.
It's a real magazine.
It's a full-fledged, regular publishing entity. But New York being New York, there's obviously going to be coastal bias. You're there any New York label can come and knock on your door. The old office was, what, down in Soho, I think?
Yep.
So, you know, any rapper can pop in, any label person.
Not only did they drop in, they were part of your peer group.
Right.
As well as athletes. It was an interesting time to be, like, 22 years old.
So basically anyone who was getting it was in.
Anyone that was getting it, but also in on the conversation.
Right.
If you listen to any of this music, and if your reaction was, you know what, we should throw these records in the street and call Calvin Butts to roll a steamroll over them, okay, you're not part of the conversation.
Right.
If you understood this stuff right from the jump and were open to going along on the journey, wherever it took you, you were fine. It was a worldwide phenomenon, but it was also very local, as we always talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Your participation said a lot about who you were as an individual. So if you weren't down with hip-hop, well, maybe we're not going to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should find something else to do. You shouldn't interact with us,
mm-hmm,
because we're not going to change our ways or our worldview, because,
mm-hmm,
you know, we have the concrete worldview of 22-year-olds here.
Infallible 22-year-olds.
It's infallible, and MC Ren is like reading my mind. We're all down for the struggle. As you evolve and understand music a little better and have different tastes, well, that's when it was easier, because there were so many categories in hip-hop, you could always have a home.
Right.
As long as you considered yourself part of the hip-hop nation.
It was under an umbrella. As long,
yeah,
you could be anywhere as long as you're under the umbrella.
So when artists would come by, well, it's not like they were being pursued by any other media outlets.
Right.
But if they were, would you talk to the 55-year-old rock critic? Or the 20-year-old guy that looks like you.
Right.
Who might not be asking you the most poignant questions, but you'd rather spend 45 minutes with.
Mm-hmm.
We established all these relationships. And then, you know, we started to, like, learn about journalism. And, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't be
right
part of the story. Maybe, mm-hmm, we shouldn't have outside relationships with our subjects, but it was so hard to separate those things.
When it was such a small community.
It was such a small community, and it was localized. You literally couldn't leave the office without running into someone, because everyone was just local.
So when it came to covering artists from outside, from other cities, how were they perceived? Like, so when you're the source in 90, and NWA eventually in 91 comes back with the second record, were you like, this is the most important thing? Or were you like, well, this is an after. This is a side thought, basically.
Well, if you'd established yourself as someone who was interested in things that went beyond the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut,
mm,
then you pretty much had a clear lane to cover that stuff.
But it wasn't wasn't the main thrust.
Everyone loved NWA, but it's like, in the office, it's like, okay, people are talking about NWA, but they're still talking about Brand Nubian.
Right.
They're still talking about A Tribe Called Quest. Like, there's still a lot of things going on in the music. De La Soul is Dead,
mm-hmm,
is out, and that's a 2-month conversation in the office,
mm-hmm,
before you even write about the records.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, when something like when Hammer comes out and excels in the manner that he did, then the argument is, what's real hip hop? What's fake hip hop?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we started to slice that pie very finely. Some people felt that NWA, because of like the sort of cartoonish interpretation that you could draw from the group, weren't real. But if you explain to them, and you know, we were like, why should we have to explain this to you?
Right.
Like, listen to the music, listen to the rapping. No one else is doing any of this stuff, and it's all together in the same package. Plus, you've never seen people who inhabit their characters like this. This,
mm-hmm,
was like having like 5 Run DMCs.
It's fascinating that it was a debate, basically. It was a debate whether it's real or not real. It's a debate whether it's central or not central. All of those things were open questions in 90, 91.
It wasn't settled law.
Right. And these are things that are like by now, like just... They're etched in the stone. Like, they're canonical texts and they're canonical ideas.
Not questioned.
But it's interesting to know that at the time, that just wasn't the case.
But you're laying the foundation. And, you know, one of the arguments we always made was, if you're concerned about the bricks, then the bricks are going to be anything. There's always going to be a brick. We're concerned about the mortar. And there were certain editors at the Source who didn't understand the mortar.
Mm.
Like, the mortar allows us to go to every ghetto in this country and feel safe,
mm-hmm,
and have conversations because it's one ongoing conversation.
Right, and then bring those stories,
yeah,
back.
If you're looking at the bricks, you're looking at a trend.
Mm-hmm.
And when something plays out, like, we don't want this extra brick anymore, it's like, no, you have to look at the wall. But the mortar is so important.
Mm-hmm.
NWA becomes this juggernaut, primarily because of the music, but also their internal struggles.
When the second album debuted so high on the charts, you know, it was a big thing. Were you guys prepared for that, or were you caught off guard?
Let me explain, like, what 1989 was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading the Source as a fan. I'm not even there yet. Ice Cube has left NWA.
Right.
The first place I heard about it was reading about it in the Source magazine, which interviewed Ice Cube on the cover, and he's talking about his solo record that's being produced by the Bomb Squad.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, when do they print this magazine? And you know, when you know publishing schedules, it's like, oh, we have this information. Man, in 6 weeks, people are going to blow their minds when they read about this. You know, I was watching MTV, you know, MTV News, mm-hmm, twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't reported.
Right.
This is a major seminal event.
Yeah. It's Led Zeppelin breaking up.
That the, you know, the waves are still crashing against the walls, mm-hmm, you know, based on that.
Yep.
Not only is this music important, this dedicated hip-hop media is also very important. And no one is telling our stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when they tell our stories on the records, the people who are writing about this don't understand what's going on. You know, if you wanted to be a journalist, you saw the place where you could fit in.
Right.
Okay, we're going to explain this to the rest of the world because it's very necessary. You know, we have access to the artists and they feel comfortable talking to us. And we're just going to do a better job. It's a musical schism, but it's also like a generation gap,
mm-hmm,
that was happening. But you know, 30-year-old black journalists didn't understand this either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mainstream journalists. It was something that you were trying to get away from. You're
right.
Trying to get away from your humble beginnings and any kind of drama. And we as young people, we were like, oh, we're attracted to the drama. And if you spend all day in an office in front of a keyboard, you probably want to be around the drama a little bit more because your life is not exciting at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have certain journalists who were never a part of anything sort of in the street. But then you had a generation that were, because like all good things in life, if there's no barrier to entry, that's when you find the best stuff.
Of course.
So when people would literally just walk in off the street with an idea or access,
mm-hmm,
or a point of view, you know, that's what the Source was. That's what hip-hop journalism was. It was a zone of non-judgment.
Mm-hmm.
We would just take whatever someone wrote, whatever they said to us, print it,
yeah,
unexpurgated.
And certainly that's true from, you know, the beginning of the Source, 80 or 88, 89, 90, probably up until Biggie and Pac die, if we're being honest. Is when things really start to change.
Well, that's the problem.
Yes. I mean,
you're the solution, but you immediately start becoming the problem because when NWA sort of fractured, well, whose side are you going to be on in terms of the magazine? Ice Cube came to our office once, and this is after America's Most Wanted and maybe around the time of his EP, Kill at Will.
Yep.
And he came with members of the lynch mob, and one of the empty loft offices adjacent to our office, we had a game of very hard touch football. So you bond with these people as young, rambunctious,
mm-hmm,
you know, relatively young people. Then you have to turn a switch and criticize their music and talk about their livelihood, which no one can really understand because it always feels like a betrayal. You could run into Ice Cube throughout the 90s and he'd be, hey, we played football in that room. We like, you know,
mm, right.
Because where else was that happening? That wasn't happening
in Rolling Stone.
No,
or Span or any of those places. So talk about how, in your period at The Source, how was what are the sort of key NWA and post NWA, you know, split solo stuff? What are the moments in the source, how they were covered, and what the approach was?
You start with Ice Cube, America's Most Wanted. You're still covering NWA. Ice Cube is the shinier toy, and he's getting a lot of the attention because, you know, as the water seeks its level, you know, we skew towards intellectualism.
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking about bigger concepts than the street.
He's the first to go solo. These are bigger
ideas to unpack. There are things to talk about because he's already established himself as the street, you know, historian. But there really isn't a problem yet. Then NWA puts out the EP, 100 Miles and Running,
mm-hmm.
and they're taking shots at Ice Cube, and it's kind of a weird thing. Well, this is their beef, and we're not going to take sides, but by praising something that's dissing Ice Cube, you know, you are taking a side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you still have to cover the music. So 100 Miles and Running comes out, and the last song previews the second full-length NWA album, Elf and Zagan.
Mm-hmm.
You get that record, it's a quantum leap in everything. You know, gangster rap at its highest level.
Mm-hmm.
The music is so well produced. It's so slick. It's something that hip hop has never had because, you know, it was always sort of like a low tech kind of thing, mm-hmm. and doing the most with nothing really.
Right.
And here, Dr. Dre obviously had a recording budget.
Mm-hmm.
That
sounds like one of those 70s rock records. It's just huge.
That could compare with anything he could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed up on the record musically. Now, the subject matter.
Yeah. I mean, there's no Cube on this record. So you're suffering.
Jeanette turning that corner intellectually. But in celebrating the N-word, you are being very political and in a mm-hmm. way that's reaching people at every level.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's a line on one of the songs, mm-hmm. one of the first three songs. It's a sample of Don King. And he says, you can be a rich N.
Mm-hmm.
You could be a poor N.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to be educated, you're an educated N, but you never stop being an N.
Mm-hmm.
That's the entire debate.
Let's actually stop there for a second and listen to a little bit of Real Ones Don't Die. Let's listen to a little bit of that, or at least as much as we can. Given the circumstance.
Here it is. Real niggas don't die because they eventually multiply. The niggas I'm with, they're taking out for an eye because the times are so wrong. Gotta stay so strong. Niggas gotta keep it going on and on. And don't let no pale face throw your ass in a snail race. Have your residence occupying a jail space. That's what they wanted to because the system is still around. I try to let you know with the records it's underground. They don't give them a fuck about it again.
Okay, so you've heard a little bit of what we've just been talking about, and the, you know, the ironies of redacting are not lost on us here at the NY Times podcast.
There wasn't a record that sounded like that. It's a fanfare. It's apocalyptic. They're answering all questions about who they are, what they believe in. You take it or leave it, but they can take something that people feel shouldn't be spoken and manifest it on the highest level possible.
Artistically. Yeah.
Where it can't be denied. You get NWA's ascendancy, but then not at full strength. Then Ice Cube drops Death Certificate,
mm-hmm.
his second album, which is cleaved in two parts, like the life side and the death side. The death side is all the NWA type material that he kills and then is reborn as this politically conscious
mm-hmm.
man of the people. And it was the most amazing transformation because, you know, we were very deep into the fine print of the autobiography of Malcolm X. So mm-hmm. we knew what this transformation was. We had never seen it happen in rap. We'd never seen it happen before our eyes that someone could go from, you know, I ain't the one, to songs on, mm-hmm. on, you know, Be True to the Game.
Mm-hmm.
It was always something to think about. And finally, when he buries NWA, he does it literally with a song called No Vaseline,
mm-hmm.
which addresses each member of the group.
Yep.
And had it not been for NWA status, the quality of their work, they would not have survived
that
this lyrical onslaught, because it's one of the great
takedowns,
diss records ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Probably all true from Ice Cube's side, and something that the film manages to capture.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't capture the full context of it.
The film also doesn't capture how that song was received outside of the specific context in which it was intended. So if you conceive of No Vaseline as a song from one guy to his four former friends, that's one thing. When you put it on a record that sells X hundred thousand or millions of copies, I'm not sure how many, and all these other people hear it, then it's homophobic, it's anti-Semitic, other stuff.
It's extra conversations that everyone is having.
Right.
Whereas they know, and you know, if Ice Cube was anti-Semitic, he wasn't apologizing for it.
Mm-hmm.
Not like Public Enemy and Professor Griff and that whole backtrack that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Ice Cube, you know, I feel wasn't castigating all Jews. He's castigating Jerry Heller.
Yeah, he's anti-Jerry Heller,
who happens to be Jewish. Right. You really can't, you know, ask someone to make that distinction from 30,000 feet up, right? In the movie, when Jerry Heller talks about the anti-Semitism, it's a theme that really ran through Death Certificate, as well as the anti-Asian immigrant sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Black Korea.
But at the time, Blacks and Koreans were not getting along from New York to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it happened to such a degree that it's, you know, the conclusion of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
an argument over these batteries and mm-hmm. you know, someone gets choked and there's a riot. It got to such a degree that the Jewish partners at the Source magazine, who were totally not with Death Certificate,
mm-hmm.
they didn't understand why Ice Cube would go down this path. Why would you, you know, insult some of your fans, people who are on your side in the struggle, which is, you know, very much like the liberal progressive argument that you see with
today.
Black Lives
yeah,
Matter
of
and
course.
Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, you know, we're drafting a college player. You still have to go to training camp to see if you could play,
mm-hmm.
to see if you could learn this playbook.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't want to learn the playbook, you really can't be on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And you should always have to prove yourself.
Ally culture is always going to—
Exactly.
The challenges of ally culture in the 80s or in the 90s are no different than the challenges today.
So and that's, when they would talk to Ice Cube, when they would interview him, and I'm talking about mainstream publications, they would focus in the absence of everything else—
Right.
on the anti-Semitism, and he really didn't have much to say about it because it's not something that he spends all day thinking about
right.
because he's not a neo-Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
He would say things like, well, they'd ask him, well, you know, you work with white people every day. And he'd say, all snakes are snakes, but not all snakes are poisonous. He always had an answer that was probably not satisfactory, you know, to the interviewer. But
those interviewers were looking for apologies.
Yeah. There was never an apology coming from anything involved in NWA,
mm-hmm.
which finally, you know, Ice Cube even says things like, you know, why black folks got to show their teeth. I'm going to be brief. You know, Ice Cube was against what he called the black sellout as much as he was against white supremacy,
mm-hmm.
how you really have to ride.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to think back at, you know, this guy's like 22 years old. And he's shouldering the weight of all these responsibilities
mm-hmm.
and getting things right, getting things wrong.
But publicly engaging in a way that really no one else at that time. Because even if you look at the more explicitly political stuff from New York at that time, it really is just one side of the coin. And it also, it's aggressive and it's politically aggressive, but also somehow for allies, it was easier to side with a Chuck D.
Mm-hmm.
Because he felt more explicitly steeped in the politics of the civil rights movement or et cetera. You know, it
That's
was a more
like,
relatable.
It's civil rights versus something that didn't even have a name,
mm-hmm.
right? This is civil rights and nothing's changed. So why are we marching? Why are we taking our cues from the SCLC? Like
mm-hmm.
what are we supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
And Nation of Islam under Farrakhan sort of stands in the gap because Farrakhan's the only person talking about black men and talking about saving black men. And people are like, well, how can you follow Farrakhan? He admits that he helped create the atmosphere that allowed Malcolm X to be assassinated, and you can debate, you know, other things there. But he was the person that was at least stepping up to start the debate. It's better if everyone is a little bit nervous than if everyone's quiet and taking things for granted. And Ice Cube didn't have to rock the boat, but he did. But it got to such a degree that at the magazine, we had to have a round table, and it was published in the magazine. I didn't participate in it because I thought it was a useless exercise. But some of the white ownership wanted to sit down and have a debate with the black editors and writers about why, like, what does this all mean? Let's talk. And none of the black editors felt that this stuff needed to be explained. And then to dedicate pages in a magazine to this debate, one editor said, I won't mention any names, but it was, in this line here, why does he have to say Jew? And the answer from the other side was, because it rhymes with to do.
And also, I imagine that was a striking moment to be working at the Source with the sort of number one, two groups of people working at the magazine, not totally seeing eye to eye or not sharing a common ground, but also the Source at that time is basically premised upon the idea of we are going to tell the stories that the mainstream media is not.
Hip hop, music, culture, and politics.
Right. It's right there under the original logo. It used to be, yes. And it was for quite some time. All of a sudden, with a debate like that in the magazine, you're inviting the outside perspective into the thing. And so that must have been strange.
People are drawing lines in the sand. They're taking sides. This is like literally like the Crown Heights riots amongst blacks and Jews, where it's really going down. It was by far not the only political debate that we would be having. This is the Mike Tyson rape trial is also happening. It's a male-female dynamic. It's what is rape, what isn't. There were all these things every day when you went to work and you had to take an entire bottle of aspirin to get through the day. And then you had to deal with the music industry. You know, it was so much. So we weren't getting any assistance from anybody. It was like the Source was the leader at that point. And we had a responsibility. No one understood the arguments that happened even before you wrote a word on a computer screen. You know, we were living these debates. It wasn't abstract. You know, relationships were strained, right? And this is just, you know, us as coworkers. Then we have artists who we were a little bit too close to, and the debate is leaking into the criticism of the music and the approaches and careers. By the time Dr. Dre leaves NWA, it's like Eazy-E has been cast as like this villain. And everyone is like, man, everyone has nothing but bad things to say about Eazy-E. There was a point where he was putting out these records without Dr. Dre, without Ren, obviously without Ice Cube. And they were just horrible records. And it seemed as if we were piling on to Eazy-E when he was down. And it wasn't the case, but there's no way it didn't look like that. And I remember I might have been writing about him in my column because like I talked to Ren and he'd just like say things and I'd like put it in my column. And he was basically saying that Eazy-E is surrounded by people, like these sycophants who are just souping him up, and he feels he doesn't need anybody else. And you know, you're going to see the type of music he makes without us. And a bad record comes out from a major artist, and, you know, sometimes you get a little bit enthused.
Of course. The fangs come out
a little
bit.
And you write things, but it's in the moment. And I remember, man, we did a number on Eazy. And one day we had rented like the next door office, which was like this giant loft. And we just had a couple of tables and a few computers in there, but nothing was built yet. It wasn't like a real office, just an empty space. And I was eating lunch. And I looked up and Eazy was standing right in front of me. And I'm a man, so mm-hmm. I wasn't shook or anything, mm-hmm. but he was right there. He knew who I was, but I didn't know where it was going to go, and I kind of look at him, and mm-hmm. he says, "Man, where'd you get those ribs?" And I told him where I got the ribs, and then he was like, "Yeah, you know, you guys, you never know what to expect when you open up the magazine." I felt out of anyone I'd ever interacted with in hip-hop that Eazy-E got it. He understood the theater. He understood building an audience. He understood mm-hmm. the Carnival Barker aspects of this because he was
That's
that.
What he relied on, yeah.
And he also knew that he wasn't a rapper, that possibly some of his output was post-NWA was uneven.
Yeah.
But it wasn't an aspersion on him or who he was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's like, "Hey, I'm doing my best, but this is not like my identity."
And he could separate himself yes. from whatever the character of the record or the presentation of the record was.
And we always said, like, I'm 49 years old. We always said that Eazy-E would be the perfect guy to hang out with when we were like in our 50s. Like when it was all said and done mm-hmm. and you could just open up some cognac and just reminisce about 25 years ago.
Mm.
He understood it. He never made a record. You know, we had well-publicized beefs where we would be called out on records and, you know, called out by name. And it was a little bit more than we bargained for. But Eazy, he didn't have that thin skin. And I think even if he did something to you where the natural reaction would be to have tension or vendetta, he always seemed to be the person that you couldn't stay mad at.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was just something about him. It was, you know, he could seduce you. He was very charming.
Mm-hmm.
When you see Ice Cube and Dr. Dre, you know, and probably Ren and Yella to an extent, you know, they lament the lost time because they didn't know that the clock was ticking.
Right.
And they spent those years of estrangement. And just when the waters were clear enough for them to get back together, mm-hmm. like it was,
right.
you know, that Eazy, moment was
And this
was
is
gone.
1995 and Eazy yes. passes away. I feel like, oddly, a bit, a person we have not spent a lot of time talking about is Dr. Dre. Which is strange because I think when people, if you ask the average person on the street, who's the person of NWA who you most easily identify, it would be Dr. Dre, whether that's because of The Chronic or 2001 or Eminem or 50 Cent. As he said in that weird Tyrese home video, first hip-hop billionaire because of the Apple Music situation, Dr. Dre has become kind of the stand-in. It's not Ice Cube, actually.
And this is the problem of documenting this material. You need multiple movies, mm-hmm. you need multiple podcasts
yes.
to talk about the contributions of each member because each member did three times as much as anybody else
mm-hmm.
that you would ever imagine talking about. It's like having like five Tupacs.
And we talked about Dre musically, both with and without Yella. At The Source, there's this very famous Dre cover of The Source, and this is 92, I believe, and it's Dre pointing a gun in his head. It's just before Death Row. It's right in right in the middle, basically.
There's a period post NWA where Dr. Dre only made the headlines based on his personal life. There was an assault of a television show host.
D. Barnes, Pump It Up.
He was charged with inciting a riot
mm-hmm.
at a music conference. He was charged with multiple assaults.
Mm-hmm.
There were rumors that he was shot. His house burned down.
Mm-hmm. Within a year or so, a year and change.
6 months.
Mm.
It was like, what is going on with Dr. Dre? Has he made a horrible mistake leaving Ruthless Records and Eazy-E?
Mm-hmm.
Deep Cover comes out, which is the first sort of post-NWA project, and he introduces the world to Snoop Doggy Dogg.
Mm-hmm.
That corner is being turned but you don't know if he's going to be there for the rest of the story.
Right.
It's very much in doubt.
Mm-hmm. And Deep Cover is it's on Interscope still.
The movie soundtrack song. It introduces the world to Snoop.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you the idea that Dre can have a viable solo career as a behind-the-microphone performer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is Dre as a rapper, possibly without the assistance of his normal collaborators.
Right.
And
his normal writing collaborators. Like, let's just say it. His normal writing collaborators.
But you never see when the DOC and Ice Cube and Ren assisted on Dre's rhymes, they knew each other so well that those rhymes were authentic as if Dr. Dre had written them. There was nothing
they're tailor-made
out of
to the
ordinary,
person.
And it wasn't anything beyond his capabilities because as a producer, he knows cadence and, like a Salt and Pepper, could just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Eazy-E was challenged. He might have been rhythmically challenged, and every line had to be punched in as a single line, and it would take hours. But on the playback, it was flawless, and then he could perform these things because he was a natural performer.
Mm-hmm.
I also know Dre probably could write rhymes, but he could write the concept
and have
form
other
out the work.
Sure.
Someone that could better articulate it.
Very early on that.
Yeah.
In a hip-hop context, this has obviously been the subject of much debate, especially in recent weeks. We talked about this on the podcast a little bit last week, and I think it's always important to remind people who are incensed about Meek and Drake and what's happening with ghostwriting right now, this is not new. And we don't even really know the full story, number one, but even if it turns out to be the worst potential version of what we think is happening with Drake, this is by no means novel, not even slightly.
But even like rappers who are known to write their own rhymes are not above getting assistance.
Of course.
Someone can solve a problem. Someone can get you in to 16 bars.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can solve that problem for you. I think back then folks, they just like to collaborate and maybe didn't argue so much about the publishing and who gets what credit and somewhere now. If you come up with half a hook for somebody,
you gotta get points.
It's horrible.
Mm-hmm. So when Dre gets on the cover in 92, what's in that story, pointing the gun in his head? What's that story capturing?
That story by Ronan Rowe captures the genesis of Death Row Records.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Dre is in comparatively diminished circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
He's starting over. He's living in an apartment with Snoop and Daz and Corrupt and spending all his time at a studio, basically taking a chance on his own talent. The story itself is about, it's him in a very charming and unmedia savvy way explaining his side of the story, which is totally hilarious because he's quite evasive. He's not sympathetic, but he's honest in that he doesn't care about his portrayal because he was still a young 26, 27 years old, fresh off of NWA, still not caring, very immature.
Mm-hmm.
But now he has the opportunity to sort of realize his creative dreams and really see if he can take things to the next level. Ice Cube already has. Eazy-E still owns his company. This is time for, Dre to try to do something. At the photo shoot, it's regular things. Dre with a lowrider, Dre and Snoop. These are like some of the first Snoop Dogg quotes that appear anywhere. The first Daz and Corrupt quotes, whatever happened to the DOC side bar.
Mm-hmm.
Suge Knight is on the premises but doesn't even make the story because
He's not the guy.
But he's there, but not trying to hijack the spotlight. It's a very brief moment. Towards the end of the photo shoot, Dr. Dre, who just happens to be carrying a .357 Magnum, starts doing some typical gangster poses with the gun, and someone asks him to put the gun to his own head. And it's one of the last pictures shot. And that cover is Dr. Dre with a 357 Magnum pointed towards his head. It was very poignant in a lot of ways. He's killing his career as we see it, or he's overcoming himself.
Right.
Right. The latter was true, and that took another 20 years.
At this point, I mean, again, Dre has done so many things over these 20 years. We're going to speed through this, but an interesting thing about The Chronic to me was always like the template of The Chronic to me was, I'm going to show off Snoop. Dre has always been slightly uncomfortable being the guy out front. That's not been the thing that he's always been great at.
Well, you know,
and he doesn't want to be.
You know, you play your position. But Death Row as a company needed Dr. Dre, just like Rockefeller needed Jay-Z, where he only wanted to make one album. Dr. Dre sucked it up because he wanted to prove to Easy and Ice Cube and everybody else, number one, he could do this on his own. Number two, this is what you could have had. And it would have been the greatest group album ever, but it'll still be one of the greatest albums ever, just be me and Snoop.
Right.
Which is a pretty good consolation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a man who, you know, grows into his stardom. Whereas it was thrust upon him, but you're talking Deep Cover, let's say 92, The Chronic's 93, or into 92, Doggy Style. When Doggy Style came out, Snoop was a rock star to the degree that had never been seen in rap music.
Sure. Also a true MTV star.
Yes.
Like a genuine MTV star.
The inheritor of everything that had gone before.
Mm-hmm.
Snoop got that, and then not only does his album come out and do what it does in the charts, but then, you know, he's charged with attempted murder at the same time, which opens the floodgates in terms of this worldwide coverage, where a person who goes from anonymity to you can't, I mean.
Yeah, pure ubiquity.
The first time I met Snoop was at a Def Jam party, and he walked around wearing a ski mask. But everybody knew who it was because he's 6'7".
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon, he couldn't even wear a ski mask and live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's how big, that's how fast it happened. By 1995, I guess it's sort of the Tupac era begins for Death Row. By the end of 95, 96, Dre departs.
Right.
And it's Aftermath, and he puts out, you know, possibly the least heralded
compilation of all time.
Ever.
Yeah. No, it's
It seemed like it was over.
Right.
That Dr. Dre had taken all this money, had all these resources, had built up this character, and had nothing to contribute anymore.
Again, and this is the last thing I want to say about the movie before we sort of close out on the Dre album, but this is also like the way that Dre is portrayed in this moment in the film strikes me as strange. Number one, that he's living in a mansion picking out the keyboard thing for Nothing But a G Thing and Snoop walks in. Like, that feels wrong. The way he exits from Death Row, some of that feels wrong. I mean, I feel like the setup for it feels right as far as like what he's seeing in the office, but in terms of the execution of it.
Narrative choices.
This is what I'm saying. This all feels selective.
Contrived.
Yes. Selective, contrived, however you want to look at it. And then, of course, what we know is what comes after this, which is the Aftermath compilation where it's like, oh, did Dr. Dre completely mess up? Like, is this... Is the era over?
For those who don't know about the Aftermath compilation, the lead single was a Dr. Dre song called "Been There, Done That," where he disavowed his participation in gangster rap and ended the song doing a waltz.
Good times, 96. Really doing good times. Dr. Dre just put a record out. This is not a small thing because Dr. Dre, as I mentioned him when I wrote about the record, very few people have had as much of an impact and are as considered as influential as they are with really as little output as Dr. Dre has had. Because basically, Dr. Dre has two albums. Let's for his benefit, not even count the Aftermath compilation. He's got The Chronic. He's got 2001, which comes out in 99. Obviously, he has his NWA stuff, but some of that's with Yella, and it's not Dr. Dre's solo stuff. And yet, Dr. Dre has continued to occupy this space. He is sort of the Eminence Grise of 2000s hip-hop. He shepherds Eminem into the game. He shepherds 50 into the game. In a way, part of the way that he's able to maintain that level of authority is, I think, and we talked about this a little bit earlier today, by not releasing records.
It's the tease.
Yeah. Detox.
And he does enough for you to believe that Detox will be a revolutionary work.
Right. And first announced in like 02 or 03, I can't quite remember, and finally announced that it will never come out about 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
So that is, if you're counting at home, that is 13
but
years.
The honesty, and again, this is an artist who might be isolated, who's achieved everything, you know, financially. And remember, when you're from the hood, having your money correct is so important.
Yes, no small
thing. It frees up your mind to do the other things. Maybe there was just too much runway at his airport.
Mm-hmm.
It might not have been necessary to take that last trip.
Mm-hmm. But it is striking that in the context of Straight Outta Compton, the movie, all of a sudden, Dre, who famously has this sort of perfection and performance anxiety, all of a sudden decides, I'm going to make a whole album in a year or 6 months or however long it took. And so Compton came out last week. I know you had a chance to listen to it. What struck you about the record, besides the fact that it exists?
It's Dr. Dre probably being a guest in his own home.
Mm.
At some point, you know he's overseeing things, but how much of it is he actually creating? The guest appearances seem, some are good, but others seem like they're just there.
Mm-hmm.
If Good Kid, Mad City, Kendrick Lamar,
mm-hmm.
was probably the first album to successfully do like the rap opera thing,
mm-hmm.
and then tell a story out of sequence and challenge the listener to follow this narrative, that was really the baton being passed, mm-hmm. in terms of Compton. But if you're on the set for a year watching your life story being produced and you're looking at the recreations of studio sessions,
mm-hmm.
why wouldn't you go home feeling energized and restored? Let me do something similar to Kendrick Lamar. Let me tell a story. But I've listened to this record, you know, for the past few days.
Mm-hmm.
I can't follow the narrative, but I believe there is a narrative.
That's probably generous. I mean, there's supposed to be.
There might be, but, and I'm not saying I'm the best listener of music, but it's a challenge. So I don't want to dismiss it right off the bat because there's enough there to keep me interested, but so much of it feels like it could have been edited just a little bit, mm-hmm. more. There's too much of one thing and maybe not enough Dre.
Oh, well, it's definitely not enough Dre, and I mean that both vocally and production-wise, although you do feel the sort of essential Dre-ness. Kind of like he's plastered atop it.
The maestro.
Yeah. He's, you know, like we talked about film scores before and all these things. Like he's a conductor. He knows what the whole thing's supposed to sound like. And he can basically taskmaster people until it gets to that thing. When he's rapping, I don't really want to hear him rapping, especially because I know he's just kind of rapping. Unlike what you were saying with N.W.A., where it's like Ren is writing rhymes and he knows what Dre's seeing every day. These kids don't know what Dre's seeing every day, for better
They're
or for
doing
worse.
Their impersonations of Dr. Dre.
Yeah.
Just like when Eazy-E had like Tretch from Naughty by Nature write rhymes for him, Tretch wrote a Naughty by Nature song.
Right.
And it's hilarious to hear Eazy-E rap. Only if you want it.
And you definitely, in the same way that when Eminem was writing for Dre, allegedly, in 99, and you hear Dre doing triplet rhymes and stuff, and you're like, no, that's not real. The same thing is happening, I think, all over this record. The only thing that I think unifies it conceptually, most of it, is, look, unlike Detox, which I think Dre perceived of as a thing that he needed to make to like push the genre in a new direction or evolutionarily.
What a great name. Detox also infers that he's overcoming something.
Mm-hmm.
Detoxing from being Dr.
Yeah,
Dre.
Could be. So there was so much pressure on what that record needed to sound like. Weirdly, because they announced this record purely as something inspired by his life and by the movie about his life, that pressure's off, which is why I think he's able to make the mm-hmm. record so quickly. And what does cut through it for me, it's warm, it's nostalgic. It's friendly in a weird way. It has nice things. There's an Eazy-E radio interview on there. There's a Bone Thugs harmony from Eazy-E's label. Your man Cold 187 from Above the Law's on there. Ice Cube people.
He's trying to recreate that moment. He's trying to create, like, the last full N.W.A. song is the final song on the D.O.C.'s album called The Grand Finale, which I ask every listener to listen to that song. It's the last of the lineup.
Mm-hmm. And we'll put it on the Spotify playlist, assuming it's on Spotify.
On the D.O.C.'s album, it's the unfulfilled promise. There was nothing left, but it's called The Grand Finale. I think Compton, a soundtrack, he's bookending that because he, even on the Chronic 2001, give me one more platinum plaque.
Mm-hmm. F-Rap, you can have it back.
You could have it back.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a jungle in his okay. Mm-hmm. He's been packing his bags literally for 15 years.
I mean, seriously. No famous rap personality, rapper, producer, whatever, has ever communicated more to his fans that he wanted no part of them than Dr. Trey.
You call it the ennui and the exasperation and the sighing and all right, leave already.
Yeah.
But you're going to miss Dre because, you know, he's 50 years old, and I care that a 50-year-old man is rapping.
Right, and in a way that is redolent of why we liked him in the first place.
I want to hear what a grown man has to say about the world. This is the sweet spot now. You know, years ago he said he wanted to get into real estate and business because he wanted music to be a hobby, something that he could just go to, return to when he felt the need, when he felt the muse. Now you can do that. You know, Detox could have been a series of mixtapes.
Mm-hmm.
Detox could have been the first 100 songs that you get when you signed on to
Tidal,
the Dre's Apple Beats thing.
Yeah.
And I really thought that's what it was going to be.
And yet, I think what Dre said in essence is, I seed the throne, or I cede the right to make this evolutionary record, or the need to make it, I'm going to go back to the comfort zone to close the circle. And so this feels like a circle closing record to me. And the only thing, you say you want to hear a 50-year-old man rap about whatever's on his mind, I do as well. Although when I know that, like, Anderson .Paak and King Mez or whatever the guy, you know, like Injustice, like when I know they don't know what's on a 50-year-old guy's mind. So that's, you know, that's ultimately the frustration.
But if we just go back for a second to, I Need a Doctor.
Yep.
That video.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't that seem like the end? The first minute of that video?
Yeah, but he's been presaging the end. This is a guy who, you know, Tupac had his way of presaging the end, and Dre has his.
When you end at Eazy-E's gravesite, and all the things that are unsaid in that moment, all the regrets that Jay-Z said that you have to learn to live with, that you can only learn to live with when you get up in age, and it hurts even more. We've never had in hip-hop someone fulfill their arc, where when it was over, it was really over. It wasn't prematurely ended. It wasn't market forces. This was
every last drop.
I won the game.
Right.
I cleared the table. This is... You know, this is unheard of in hip-hop. And yeah, it took him 29 years to do this.
But now we know what it looks like.
We know what it looks like, but as fans, of course, like, we're not satisfied.
No.
And he complains all through his album that you're never satisfied.
Yes.
And the fans are just like these cruel masters, and I'm not indentured to you anymore. I've given you the best material I could do at the time.
Right.
Please humbly accept
it. And let me out.
Let me out.
With that in mind, let's listen to one of the real true circle closing records off of Compton, which is Talking to My Diary, which is, again, if I'm going to hear Dre rapping and he's not rapping about being a billionaire, I would like to hear him rapping about what it was like to be friends at that time. So let's listen a little bit of that.
I know Eazy can see me now looking down through the clouds. And regardless, I know still proud. It's been a while since we spoke, but you still my folks. We used to sit back, laugh, and joke. Now I remember when we used to do all-nighters. You in the booth and Cube in the corner writing. Where Ren at?
Shout out to my yellow. Damn, I missed that. Having flashbacks.
When I open up my book, I think about the world later. No ink in the pen, no lines on the paper.
I'm just talking to my diary.
And that's our show this week. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our guest, Reggie Dennis, both for being here and sharing some tales from the Golden Age, but also for assigning me a review of Stretch Armstrong's Dolo Records Lesson Number 1 compilation in XXL Number 2 in 1997, which is one of the reasons I am here today.
That's a good record.
I mean, also, if I remember correctly, no shots on Stretch, but I remember us having a conversation about the album cover, and it was a girl in bed, and her dream bubble is a picture of Stretch Armstrong cutting records, and you're like, oh, that's unlikely. Mm. So yes, thank you for that. Check out our playlist on Spotify. We will be loading it up with NWA and gangster rap classics. I will be tracking down as much vintage source as I can find on the internet to go to the blog post for this podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Our producers are the indefatigable Tamara Best and Jocelyn Gonzalez. Come see us next week.